The hint that we are old friends will set them afire with curiosity and make people who thought that they knew everything just a little less sure of themselves. He smiled at Zenedra. You are positively ravishing tonight, my dear, he told her. Zenedra glowed, then looked archly at Geryon.
Why don't you take a few notes, dear?
She suggested.
You could learn a great deal from His Majesty here.
She turned back to Zakath.
You are so very kind to say it,
she told him.
But my hair is an absolute disaster.
Her expression was faintly tragic as she lightly touched her curls with her fingertips. Actually, her hair was stupendous, with a coronet of braids interwoven with strings of pearls and with a cascade of coppery ringlets spilling down across the front of her left shoulder. During this polite exchange, the others in their party were being introduced. Silk and velvet caused quite a stir, he in his jewel-encrusted doublet and she in a gown of lavender brocade. Zenedra sighed enviously.
I wish I could wear that color,
she murmured.
You can wear any color you want to, Zenedra, Geryon told her.
Are you colorblind, Geryon?
She retorted.
A girl with red hair cannot wear lavender.
If that's all that's bothering you, I can change the color of your hair any time you want.
Don't you dare,
she gasped, her hands going protectively to the cascade of auburn curls at her shoulder.
Just a suggestion, dear.
The herald at the top of the stairs announced Tzadi, Eriond, and Toth as a group, obviously having some difficulty with the fact that the boy and the giant had no rank that he could discern. The next presentation, however, filled his voice with awe and his bony limbs with trembling.
Her Grace, the Duchess of Erat, he declaimed. Lady Polgara, the sorceress.
The silence following that announcement was stunned.
And Goodman Durnick of Sindaria,
the herald added.
The man with two lives.
Polgara and the smith descended the stairs to the accompaniment of profound silence. The bows and curtsies which acknowledged the legendary couple were so deep as to resemble genuflections before an altar. Polgara, dressed in her customary silver-trimmed blue, swept through the hall with all of the regal bearing of an empress. She wore a mysterious smile, and the fabled white lock at her brow glowed in the candlelight as she and Durnick approached the platform. Meanwhile, at the top of the stairs, the herald had shrunk back from the next guest, his eyes wide and his face gone quite pale.
"Just say it," Geryon heard his grandfather tell the frightened man. "I am fairly sure that they will all recognize the name."
The herald stepped to the marble railing at the front of the landing.
"Your Majesty," he said falteringly. "My lords and ladies, I have the unexpected honor to present Belgarath, the sorcerer."
A gasp ran through the hall as the old man, dressed in a cowled robe of soft gray wool, stumped down the stairs with no attempt at grace or dignity. The assembled Malorian notables pulled back from him as he walked toward the table, where the others had already joined Zakath. About halfway to the imperial platform, however, a blonde Melsine girl in a low-cut gown caught his eye. She stood stricken with awe, unable to curtsy or even to move, as the most famous man in all the world approached her. Belgarath stopped, looked her up and down quite slowly and deliberately, noting with appreciation just how revealing her gown was. A slow, insinuating smile crept across his face, and his blue eyes twinkled outrageously.
"Nice dress," he told her.
She blushed furiously. He laughed, reached out and patted her cheek.
"There's a good girl," he said.
"Father,"
Polgara said firmly.
"Coming, Paul,"
he chuckled, and moved along the carpet toward the table. The pretty Melusine girl looked after him, her eyes wide and her hand pressed to the cheek he had touched.
"Isn't he disgusting?"
Zinedra muttered.
"It's just the way he is, dear,"
Geryon disagreed.
"He doesn't pretend to be anything else. He doesn't have to."
The banquet featured a number of exotic dishes that Geryon could not put a name to, and several which he did not even know how to eat. A deceptively innocent-looking rice dish was laced with such fiery seasonings that it brought tears to his eyes and sent his hand clutching for his water goblet.
"Balar, Mara, and Nedra!"
Durnik choked, as he also groped about in search of water. So far as he could remember, it was the first time Geryon had ever heard Durnik swear. He did it surprisingly well.
"Piquant,"
Tsadi commented, as he calmly continued to eat the dreadful concoction.
"How can you eat that?"
Geryon demanded in amazement. Tsadi smiled.
"You forget that I am used to being poisoned, Belgarion. Poison tends to toughen the tongue and fireproof the throat."
Zakoth had watched their reactions with some amusement.
"I should have warned you,"
he apologized.
"The dish comes from Gandahar, and the natives of that region entertain themselves during the rainy season by trying to build bonfires in each other's stomachs. They are elephant trappers for the most part, and they pride themselves on their courage."
After the extended banquet, the brown-robed Braedor approached Geryon.
"If your majesty wouldn't mind," he said, leaning forward so that Geryon could hear him over the sounds of laughter and sprightly conversation from nearby tables. "There are a number of people who are most eager to meet you."
Geryon nodded politely, even though he inwardly winced. He had been through this sort of thing before, and he knew how tedious it usually became. The chief of the Bureau of Internal Affairs led him down from the platform into the swirl of brightly clad celebrants, pausing occasionally to exchange greetings with various fellow officials and to introduce Geryon. Geryon braced himself for an hour or two of total boredom. The plump, bald-headed Braedor, however, proved to be an entertaining escort. Though he seemed to be engaging Geryon in light conversation, he was, in fact, providing a succinct and often pointed briefing, even as they went.
"We'll be talking with the kinglet of Palia," he murmured, as they approached a group of men in tall conical felt caps, who wore leather, which had been dyed an unhealthy-looking green color. "He's a fawning bootlicker, a liar, a coward, and absolutely not to be trusted."
"Ah, there you are, Braedor,"
one of the felt-capped men greeted the Melusine with a forced heartiness.
"Your Highness," Braedor replied, with a florid bow. "I have the honor to present His Royal Majesty, Belgarion of Riva."
He turned to Geryon.
"Your Majesty, this is His Highness, King Warasen of Palia."
"Your Majesty,"
Warasen gushed, bowing awkwardly. He was a man with a narrow, pockmarked face, close-set eyes, and a slack-lipped mouth. His hands, Geryon noticed, were not particularly clean.
"Your Highness,"
Geryon replied, with a slightly distant note.
"I was just telling the members of my court here that I'd have sooner believed that the sun would rise in the north tomorrow than that the Overlord of the West would appear at Malzeth."
"The world is full of surprises."
"By the beard of Torak, you are right, Belgarion. You do not mind if I call you Belgarion, do you, Your Majesty?"
"Torak didn't have a beard," Geryon corrected shortly.
"What?"
"Torak. He didn't have a beard. At least he didn't when I met him."
"When you..."
Warrison's eyes suddenly widened.
"Are you telling me that all those stories about what happened at Tor Mishrek are actually true?"
he gasped.
"I'm not sure, Your Highness," Geryon told him. I have not heard all of the stories yet. It's been an absolute delight meeting you, old boy, he said, clapping the stunned-looking kinglet on the shoulder with exaggerated camaraderie. It's a shame that we don't have more time to talk. Coming, Braydor? He nodded to the petty king of Palia, turned and led the Melsine away.
You're very scared, Belgarian, Braydor murmured. Much more so than I would have imagined, considering.
He hesitated. Considering the fact that I look like an unlettered country oaf? Garion supplied.
I don't know that I'd put it exactly that way.
Why not? Garion shrugged. It's the truth, isn't it? What was Pig Eyes back there trying to maneuver the conversation around to? It was pretty obvious that he was leading up to something.
It's fairly simple, Braydor replied. He recognizes your current proximity to Khal Zakath. All power in Meloria derives from the throne, and a man who has the Emperor's ear is in a unique position. Horacin is currently having a border dispute with the Prince Regent of Dershin, and he probably wants you to put in a good word for him.
Braydor gave him an amused look.
You're in a position right now to make millions, you know.
Garion laughed. I couldn't carry it, Braydor. I visited the royal treasury at Riva once, and I know how much a million weighs. Who's next?
The chief of the Bureau of Commerce. An unmitigated, unprincipled ass. Like most Bureau chiefs.
Garion smiled. And what does he want? Braydor tugged thoughtfully at one earlobe.
I'm not entirely certain. I have been out of the country. Vaska's a devious one, though, so I would be careful of him.
Oh, I'm always careful, Braydor. The Baron Vaska, chief of the Bureau of Commerce, was wrinkled and bald. He wore the brown robe that seemed to be almost the uniform of the bureaucracy, and the gold chain of his office seemed almost too heavy for his thin neck. Though at first glance he appeared to be old and frail, his eyes were as alert and shrewd as those of a vulture.
"Ah, Your Majesty," he said, after they had been introduced. "I'm so pleased to meet you at last."
"My pleasure, Baron Vaska," Garion said politely. They chatted together for some time, and Garion could not detect anything in the Baron's conversation that seemed in the least bit out of the ordinary.
"I know that Prince Keldar of Dresnia is a member of your party,"
the Baron said finally. "We are old friends. You are acquainted with Keldar then, Baron?"
"We have had a few dealings together. The customary permits and gratuities, you understand. For the most part, though, he tends to avoid contact with the authorities."
"I have noticed that from time to time," Garion said.
"I was certain that you would have. I won't keep your majesty. Many others here are eager to meet you, and I would not want to be accused of monopolizing your time. We must talk again, soon."
The Baron turned to the chief of the Bureau of Internal Affairs.
"So good of you to introduce us, my dear Braydor."
"It's nothing, my dear Baron," Braydor replied.
He took Garion by the arm and then moved away from Vaska. What was that all about?
"I'm not altogether sure," Braydor replied. "But whatever he wanted, he seems to have gotten."
"We didn't really say anything."
"I know. That's what worries me. I think I'll have my old friend Vaska watched. He has managed to arouse my curiosity."
During the next couple of hours, Garion met two more gaudily dressed petty kings, a fair number of more soberly garbed bureaucrats, and a sprinkling of semi-important nobles and their ladies.
many of them, of course, wanted nothing more than to be seen talking to him, so that later they could say in a casual, offhand fashion,
"I was talking with Belgarian the other day, and he said..."
Others made some point of suggesting that a private conversation might be desirable at some later date. A few even tried to set up specific appointments. It was rather late when Velvet finally came to his rescue. She approached the place where Geryon was trapped by the royal family of Peldane, a stodgy little kinglet in a mustard-yellow turban, his simpering, scrawny wife in a pink gown that clashed horribly with her orange hair, and three spoiled royal brats who spent their time whining and hitting each other.
"Your Majesty," the blonde girl said with a curtsy, "your wife asks your permission to retire."
"Asks?
She is feeling slightly unwell?"
Geryon gave her a grateful look.
"I must go to her at once, then," he said quickly. He turned to the Peldane royalty. "I hope you will all excuse me," he said to them.
"Of course, Belgarion,"
the kinglet replied graciously.
"And please convey our regards to your lovely wife,"
the queenlet added. The royal brood continued to howl and kick at each other.
"You looked a bit harried,"
Velvet murmured as she led Geryon away.
"I could kiss you."
Now that is an interesting suggestion."
Geryon glanced sourly back over his shoulder.
"They should drown those three little monsters and raise a litter of puppies instead."
"Piglets,"
she corrected. He looked at her.
"At least they could sell the bacon,"
she explained.
"That way, the effort would not be a total loss."
"Is Synedra really ill?"
"Of course not. She has made as many conquests as she wants to this evening, that is all. She wants to save a few for future occasions. Now it's time for the grand withdrawal, leaving a horde of disappointed admirers who were all panting to meet her, crushed with despair."
"Well, that's a peculiar way to look at it."
She laughed affectionately, linking her arm in his.
"Not if you are a woman, it is not."
The following morning, shortly after breakfast, Geryon and Belgarath were summoned to meet with Zakath and Brador in the Emperor's private study. The room was large and comfortable, lined with books and maps and with deeply upholstered chairs clustered about low tables. It was a warm day outside, and the windows stood open, allowing a blossom-scented spring breeze to ruffle the curtains.
"Good morning, gentlemen,"
Zakath greeted them as they were escorted into the room.
"I hope you slept well."
"Once I managed to get Synedra out of the tub," Geryon laughed. "It's just a bit too convenient, I think. Would you believe that she bathed 3 times yesterday?"
"Mal'zeth is very hot and dusty in the summertime," Zakath said. "The baths make it bearable."
"How does the hot water get to them?"
Geryon asked curiously.
"I haven't seen anyone carrying pails up and down the halls."
"It is piped in under the floors," the Emperor replied. "The artisan who devised the system was rewarded with a baronetcy."
"I hope you don't mind if we steal the idea. Durnik is already making sketches."
"I think it is unhealthy myself," Belgarath said. "Bathing should be done out of doors, in cold water. All of this pampering softens people."
He looked at Zakath.
"I am sure you didn't ask us here to discuss the philosophical ramifications of bathing, though." "Not unless you really want to, Belgarath,"
Zakath replied. He straightened in his chair.
"Now that we have all had a chance to rest from our journey, I thought that maybe it was time for us to get to work. Brador's people have made their reports to him, and he is ready to give us his assessment of the current situation in Karanda. Go ahead, Brador."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
The plump, bald Melsine rose from his chair and crossed to a very large map of the Malorian continent, hanging on the wall. The map was exquisitely colored with blue lakes and rivers, green prairies, darker green forests, and brown, white-topped mountains. Instead of simply being dots on the map, the cities were represented by pictures of buildings and fortifications. The Malorian highway system, Geryon noted, was very nearly as extensive as the Tolnedra network in the west. Braedor cleared his throat, fought for a moment with one of Zakath's ferocious kittens for the long pointer he wanted to use, and began.
"As I reported to you in Rakhaga," he said, "a man named Minga came out of the immense forest to the north of Lake Coranda some 6 months ago."
He tapped the representation of a large belt of trees stretching from the Kerandese range to the mountains of Zamad.
"We know very, very little about his background."
"That is not entirely true, Braedor," Belgarath disagreed. "Saratus told us that he is a Grolem priest, or used to be. That puts us in a position to deduce quite a bit.
I would be interested to hear whatever you can come up with," Zakath said.
Belgarath squinted around the room, his eyes fixed on several full crystal decanters and some polished glasses sitting on a sideboard across the room.
"Do you mind?" he asked, pointing at the decanters. "I think better with a glass in my hand." "Help yourself," Zakath replied.
The old man rose, crossed to the sideboard, and poured himself a glass of ruby red wine. "Geryon?" he asked, holding out the decanter.
"No, thanks all the same, Grandfather."
Belgarath replaced the crystal stopper with a clink and began to pace up and down on the blue carpet.
"All right. We know that the demon worship persists in the back country of Coranda, even though the Grolem priest tried to stamp out the practice when the Korans were converted to the worship of Turak in the second millennium. We also know that Minga was a priest himself. Now, if the Grolems here in Meloria reacted in the same way that the ones in Tol Muragos did when they heard about the death of Turak, then we know that they were thoroughly demoralized. The fact that Euron spent several years scrambling around trying to find prophecies that would hint at the possibility of a justification for keeping the church intact is fairly good evidence that he was faced with almost universal despair in the ranks of the Grolems."
He paused to sip at his wine.
"Not bad," he said to Zakath approvingly. "Not bad at all. Thank you. Now," the old man continued, "there are many possible reactions to religious despair. Some men go mad. Some men try to lose themselves in various forms of dissipation. Some men refuse to admit the truth and try to keep the old forms alive. A few men, however, go in search of some new kind of religion, usually something the exact opposite of what they believed before. Since the Grolem Church in Coranda had concentrated for aeons on eradicating demon worship, it is only logical that a few of the despairing priests would seek out demon masters in the hope of learning their secrets. Remember, if you can actually control a demon, it gives you a great deal of power, and the hunger for power has always been at the core of the Grolem mentality."
"It does fit together, Ancient One," Braedor admitted.
"I thought so myself. All right. Torak is dead, and Minga suddenly finds that his theological ground has been cut out from under him. He probably goes through a period of doing all of those things that he was not allowed to do as a priest, drinking, winching, that sort of thing. But if you do things to excess, eventually they become empty and unsatisfying. Even debauchery can get boring after a while."
"Aunt Paul will be amazed to hear that you said that," Geryon said.
"You just keep it to yourself," Belgarath told him. "Our arguments about my bad habits are the cornerstone of our relationship.
He took another sip of his wine. "This is really excellent," he said, holding up the glass to admire the color of the wine in the sunlight. "Now, then, here we have Minga, waking up some morning with a screaming headache, a mouth that tastes like a chicken coop, and a fire in his stomach that no amount of water will put out. He has no real reason to go on living. He might even take out his sacrificial gutting knife and set the point against his chest."
"Isn't your speculation going a bit far afield?" Zakath asked.
Belgrath laughed.
"I used to be a professional storyteller," he apologized. "I can't stand to let a good story slip by without a few artistic touches." "All right. Maybe he did, or maybe he did not think about killing himself. The point is that he had reached the absolute rock bottom, and that's when the idea of demons came to him. Raising demons is almost as dangerous as being the first man up the scaling ladder during an assault on a fortified city. But Minga has nothing to lose. So he journeys into the forest up there, finds a Kerendese magician, and somehow persuades him to teach him the art, if that's what you want to call it. It takes him about a dozen years to learn all of the secrets."
"How did you arrive at that number?" Braedor asked.
Belgarath shrugged. "It has been about 14 years since the death of Torek. Thereabouts, anyway. No normal man can seriously mistreat himself for more than a couple of years before he starts to fall apart. So, it was probably about 12 years ago that Minga went in search of a magician to give him instruction. Then, once he's learned all of the secrets, he kills his teacher and..."
"Wait a minute," Zakath objected. "Why would he do that?"
"His teacher knew too much about him, and he could also raise demons to send after our defrocked Grolem. Then there is the fact that the arrangement between teacher and pupil in these affairs involves lifetime servitude, enforced with a curse. Minga could not leave his master until the old man was dead."
"How do you know so much about this, Belgarath?" Zakath asked.
"I went through it all among the Morindum a few thousand years ago. I wasn't doing anything very important, and I was curious about magic."
"Did you kill your master?"
"No. Well, not exactly. When I left him, he sent his familiar demon after me. I took control of it and sent it back to him."
"And it killed him?"
"I assume so. They usually do. Anyway, getting back to Minga, he arrives at the gates of Kalida about 6 months ago, raises a whole army of demons. Nobody in his right mind raises more than one at a time, because they are too difficult to control."
He frowned, pacing up and down, staring at the floor.
"The only thing I can think of is that somehow he has managed to raise a demon lord and get it under control."
"Demon lord?" Garion asked.
"They have rank two, just as humans do. If Minga has a grip on a demon lord, then it is that creature that is calling up the army of lesser demons."
He refilled his glass, looking faintly satisfied with himself. "That is probably fairly close to Minga's life story," he said, sitting down again.
"A virtuoso performance, Belgarath,"
Zakath congratulated him.
"Thank you," the old man replied. "I thought so myself."
He looked at Braedor. "Now that we know him, why don't you tell us what he has been up to?"
Braedor once again took his place beside the map, fending off the same kitten with his pointer.
"After Minga took Kalida, word of his exploits ran all through Koranda. It appears that the worship of Torak was never really very firmly ingrained in the Korans to begin with.
and about the only thing that kept them in line was their fear of the sacrificial knives of the Grolems.
Like the Tulls? Geryon suggested.
Very much so, Your Majesty. Once Torak was dead, however, and his church in disarray, the Karans began to revert. The old shrines began to reappear, and the old rituals come back into practice.
Raydor shuddered.
Hideous rites, he said. Obscene.
Even worse than the Grolem rite of sacrifice?
Geryon asked mildly.
There are some justifications for that, Geryon,
Z'Kath objected.
It was an honor to be chosen, and the victims went under the knife willingly.
Not any of them that I ever saw, Geryon disagreed.
We can discuss comparative theology some other time, Belgareth told them.
Go on, Braedor.
Once the Karans heard about Minga, the Melsine official continued, they began to flock to Kalida to support him and to enlist themselves on the side of the demons. There has always been a subterranean independence movement in the Seven Kingdoms of Karanda, and many hotheads there believe that the demons offer the best hope of throwing off the yoke of Angorak oppression.
He looked at the Emperor.
No offense intended, Your Majesty.
And none taken, Braedor, Z'Kath assured him.
Naturally, the little kinglets in Karanda tried to keep their people from joining Minga. The loss of subjects is always painful to a ruler. The army, our army, was also alarmed by the hordes of Karans flocking to Minga's banner, and they tried to block off borders and the like. But since a large portion of the army was in Tolmogos with His Majesty, the troops in Karanda just did not have the numbers. The Karans either slipped around them or simply overwhelmed them. Minga's army numbers almost 1 million by now, ill-equipped and poorly trained. But 1 million is a significant number, even if they are armed with sticks. Not only Geno, but also Ganesia, are totally under Minga's domination, and he is on the verge of overwhelming Katakor. Once he succeeds there, he will inevitably move on Palya and Dalchin. If he is not stopped, he will be knocking on the gates of Malzeth by Eristide.
Is he unleashing his demons in these campaigns?
Belgareth asked intently.
Not really, Braedor replied. After what happened at Kalida, there has been no real need for that. The sight of them alone is usually enough to spring open the gates of any city that he has taken so far. He has succeeded with remarkably little actual fighting.
The old man nodded.
I sort of thought that might have been the case. A demon is very hard to get back under control once it has tasted blood.
It's not really the demons that are causing the problems,
Braedor continued.
Minga has flooded all of the rest of Karanda with his agents, and the stories that they are circulating are whipping previously uncommitted people into a frenzy.
He looked at the Emperor.
Would you believe that we actually caught one of his missionaries in the Kerandese barracks right here in Malzeth?
Z'Kath looked up sharply.
How did he get in?
He demanded.
He disguised himself as a corporal returning from convalescent leave at home, Braedor replied. He had even gone so far as to give himself a wound to make his story look authentic. It was very believable, the way he cursed Murgos.
What did you do to him?
Unfortunately, he didn't survive the questioning, Braedor said, frowning.
He bent to remove the kitten from around his ankle.
Unfortunately,
I had some interesting plans for him. I take it rather personally when someone manages to circumvent my secret police.
It's a matter of professional pride.
What do you advise, then?
Zakath asked. Brador began to pace.
I am afraid that you are going to have to bring the army back from Tol Mergos, Your Majesty. You can't fight a war on two fronts.
Absolutely, out of the question.
Zakath's tone was adamant.
I don't think we have much choice, Brador told him. Almost half of the forces left here in Meloria are of Karandi's origin, and it's my considered opinion that to rely upon them in any kind of confrontation with Minga would be sheer folly.
Zakath's face grew bleak.
Put it this way, Your Majesty, Brador said smoothly. If you weaken your forces in Tol Mergos, it's quite possible that you will lose Rak'taha and maybe Rak'Gorot. But if you don't bring the army home, you are going to lose Mal'Zeth.
Zakath glared at him.
There is still time to consider the matter, sire,
Brador added in a reasonable tone of voice.
This is only my assessment of the situation. I'm sure you want to confirm all of what I have said from military intelligence, and you will need to consult with the High Command.
No, Zakath said bluntly. The decision is mine.
He scowled at the floor.
All right, Brador. We will bring the army home. Go tell the High Command that I want to see them all at once.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Geryon had risen to his feet. How long will it take to ship in your troops from Tol Mergos? He asked it with a sinking feeling.
About 3 months, Zakath replied.
I can't wait that long, Zakath.
I am very sorry, Geryon, but none of us has any choice. Neither you nor I will leave Mal'Zeth until the army gets here.
Chapter 8. The following morning, Silk came early to the rooms Geryon shared with Zenedra. The little man once again wore his doublet and hose, though he had removed most of his jewelry. Over his arm he carried a pair of Malorian robes, the lightweight, varicolored garments worn by most of the citizens of Mal'Zeth.
"Would you like to go into the city?" he asked Geryon. "I don't think they'll let us out of the palace."
"I've already taken care of that. Brador gave his permission, provided that we don't try to get away from the people who are going to be following us."
"Well, that's a depressing thought. I hate being followed."
"Oh, you get used to it."
"Have you got anything specific in mind, or is this just a sightseeing tour?"
"I want to stop by our offices here and have a talk with our factor."
Geryon gave him a puzzled look.
"The agent who handles things for us here in Mal'Zeth."
"Oh, I hadn't heard the word before."
"That's because you aren't in business. Our man here is named Dolmar. He's a Mal'Zeth, very efficient, and he doesn't steal too much."
"I'm not sure that I'd enjoy listening to you talk business," Geryon said.
Silk looked about furtively.
"You might learn all kinds of things, Geryon," he said,
but his fingers were already moving rapidly. "Dolmar can give us a report on what's really happening in Karanda," he gestured. "I think you had better come along."
"Well," Geryon said with slightly exaggerated acquiescence, "maybe you're right. Besides, the walls here are beginning to close in on me."
"Here," Silk said, holding out one of the robes. "Wear this."
"It's not really cold, Silk."
"The robe is not to keep you warm. People in Western clothing attract a lot of attention on the streets of Mal'Zeth, and I don't like being stared at."
Silk grinned quickly.
"It's very hard to pick pockets when everybody in the street is watching you. Shall we go?"
The robe Geryon put on was open at the front and hung straight from his shoulders to his heels. It was a serviceable outer garment, with deep pockets at the sides. The material of which it was made was quite thin, and it flowed out behind him as he moved around. He went to the door of the adjoining room. Zenedra was combing her hair, still damp from her morning bath. "I'm going into the city with Silk," he told her. "Do you need anything?" She thought about that.
"See if you can find me a comb," she said,
holding up the one she had been using.
"Mine is starting to look a little toothless."
"All right," he turned to leave.
"As long as you are going anyway," she added, "why don't you pick me up a bolt of silk cloth? Teal green, if you can find it. I am told there is a dressmaker here in the palace with a great deal of skill."
"I'll see what I can do," he turned again.
"And perhaps a few yards of lace, not too ornate, just tasteful."
"Anything else?" she smiled at him.
"Buy me a surprise of some kind. I love surprises."
"A comb, a bolt of teal green silk, a few yards of tasteful lace, and a surprise." He ticked them off on his fingers.
"Get me one of those robes like you are wearing, too," he waited.
She pursed her lips thoughtfully.
"That's all I can think of, Geryon. But you and Silk might ask Lysel and Lady Polgara if they need anything."
He sighed.
"It's only polite, Geryon."
"Yes, dear. Maybe I'd better make out a list." Silk's face was blandly expressionless as Geryon came back out. "Well?" Geryon asked him. "I didn't say anything." "Good." They started out the door.
"Geryon!"
Zenedra called after him. "Yes, dear?"
"See if you can find some sweetmeats, too."
Geryon went out into the hall behind Silk and firmly closed the door behind him. "You handle that sort of thing very well," Silk said. "Practice." Velvet added several items to Geryon's growing list, and Polgara several more. Silk looked at the list as they walked down the long, echoing hallway toward the main part of the palace. "I wonder if Braedor would lend us a pack mule," he murmured. "Quit trying to be funny." "Would I do that?" "Why were we talking with our fingers back there?" "Spies." "In our private quarters?" Geryon was shocked, remembering Zenedra's sometimes aggressive indifference to the way she was dressed, or not dressed, when they were just alone. "Private places are where the most interesting secrets are to be found. No spy ever passes up the opportunity to peek into a bedroom." "That's disgusting," Geryon exclaimed, his cheeks burning. "Oh, of course it is. Fairly common practice, though." They passed through the vaulted rotunda just inside the gold-plated main door of the palace and walked out into a bright spring morning, touched with a fragrant breeze. "You know," Silk said, "I like Melzeth. It always smells so good. Our office here is upstairs over a bakery, and some mornings the smells from downstairs almost make me swoon." There was only the briefest of pauses at the gates of the Imperial Complex. A curt gesture from one of the pair of unobtrusive men who were following them advised the gate guards that Silk and Geryon were to be allowed to pass into the city. "Policemen do have their uses sometimes," Silk said as they started down a broad boulevard leading away from the palace. The streets of Malazeth teemed with people from all over the Empire, and not a few from the west as well. Geryon was a bit surprised to see a sprinkling of Tonedran mantles among the varicolored robes of the local populace, and here and there were Sindars, Drasnians, and a fair number of Nadrax. There were, however, no Murgos. "Busy place," he noted to Silk. "Oh, yes. Malzeth makes Tolhanath look like a country fair, and Kamar like a village market." "It's the biggest commercial center in the world, then?" "No, that is Melusine. Of course, Melusine concentrates on money instead of goods. You can't even buy a tin pot in Melusine. All you can buy there is money." "Silk, how can you make any kind of profit buying money with money?" "It is a little complicated." Silk's eyes narrowed.
Do you know something? If you could put your hands on the royal treasury of Riva, I could show you how to double it in 6 months on Passa Street in Melsine, with a nice commission for the both of us thrown in for good measure.
You want me to speculate with the royal treasury? I'd have an open insurrection on my hands if anybody ever found out about it.
Oh, that's the secret, Geryon. You don't let anybody find out.
Have you ever had an honest thought in your entire life?
The little man thought about it.
Not that I recall, no, he replied candidly. But then, I have got a well-trained mind.
The offices of the commercial empire of Silk and Yarblek, here in Malzeth, were, as the little man had indicated, rather modest, and were situated above a busy bake shop. Access to that second floor was by way of an outside stairway, rising out of a narrow side street. As Silk started up the stairs, a certain tension that Geryon had not even been aware of seemed to flow out of his friend.
I hate not being able to talk freely, he said. There are so many spies in Malzeth that every word you say here is delivered to Braedor in triplicate before you get your mouth shut.
Well, there are bound to be spies around your office, too.
Of course, but they can't hear anything. Yarblek and I had a solid foot of cork built into the floors, ceilings, and walls.
Cork?
It muffles all the sound.
Didn't that cost a great deal?
Silk nodded.
But we made it all back during the first week. We were here, by managing to keep certain negotiations secret.
He reached into an inside pocket and took out a large brass key.
Let's see if I can catch Dalmar with his hands in the cash box, he half-whispered.
Why? You already know that he is stealing from you.
Oh, certainly I do. But if I catch him, I can reduce his year-end bonus.
Why not just pick his pocket?
Silk tapped the brass key against his cheek as he thought about it.
No, he decided finally. That's not really good business. A relationship like this is founded on trust.
Geryon began to laugh.
Oh, you have to draw the line somewhere, Geryon.
Silk quietly slipped his brass key into the lock and slowly turned it. Then he abruptly shoved the door open and jumped into the room.
Good morning, Prince Keldar,
the man seated behind a plain table said quite calmly.
I have been expecting you.
Silk looked a bit crestfallen. The man sitting at the table was a thin Malsine, with crafty, close-set eyes, thin lips, and scraggly mud-brown hair. He had the kind of face that one instantly distrusts. Silk straightened.
Good morning, Dalmar. This is Belgarion of Riva.
Your Majesty.
Dalmar rose and bowed.
Dalmar?
The way that all sounds of walking or moving pieces of furniture were muted testified to the thickness of the cork lying beneath.
How is business? Silk asked,
seating himself and pushing the other chair to Geryon with his foot.
We are paying the rent,
Dalmar replied cautiously.
I'm sure that the baker downstairs is overjoyed.
Specifics, Dalmar.
I have been away from Malzeth for quite a while. Stun me with how well my investments here are doing.
We are up 15% from last year.
That's all?
Silk sounded disappointed.
We have just made quite a large investment in inventory. If you take the current value of that into account, the number would be much closer to 40%.
That's more like it. Why are we accumulating inventory?
Yarblek's instructions. He's at Mal Kamat right now, arranging for ships to take the goods to the west. I expect that he will be here in a week or so. He and that foul-mouthed wench of his.
Dalmar stood up, carefully gathered the documents from the table, and crossed to an iron stove sitting in the corner. He bent, opened the stove door, and calmly laid the parchment sheets on the small fire inside. To Geryon's amazement, Silk made no objection to his factor's blatant incendiarism.
We have been looking into the wool market,
the Malsine reported as he returned to his now empty table.
With the growing mobilization, the Bureau of Military Procurement is in certain need of wool uniforms, cloaks, and blankets. If we can buy an option from all of the major sheep producers, we will control the market and perhaps break the stranglehold that the Malsine Consortium has on military purchases. If we can just get our foot in the door of the Bureau, I am sure that we can get a chance to bid on all sorts of contracts.
Silk was pulling at his long, pointed nose. His eyes narrowed in thought.
Beans,
he said shortly.
I beg your pardon?
Look into the possibility of tying up this year's bean crop. A soldier can live in a worn-out uniform, but he has to eat. If we control the bean crop, and maybe coarse flour as well, the Bureau of Military Procurement won't have any choice. They will have to come to us.
Ah, very shrewd, Prince Keldar.
Oh, I've been around for a while, Silk replied.
The consortium is meeting this week in Malsine, the factor reported. They will be setting the prices of common items. We really want to get our hands on that price list if we can.
I'm in the palace, Silk said. Maybe I can pry it out of somebody.
There is something else you should know, Prince Keldar. Word has leaked out that the consortium is also going to propose certain regulations to Baron Vaska of the Bureau of Commerce. They will present them under the guise of protecting the economy. But the fact of the matter is that they are aimed at you and Yablek. They want to restrict Western merchants who gross more than 10 million a year to 2 or 3 enclaves on the West Coast. That would not inconvenience smaller merchants, but it would probably put us out of business.
Can we bribe someone to put a stop to it?
We are already paying Vaska a fortune to leave us alone, but the consortium is throwing money around like water. It is possible that the Baron will not stay bribed.
Oh, let me nose around inside the palace a bit, before you double Vaska's bribe or anything.
Bribery is the standard procedure, Prince Keldar.
Oh, I know. But sometimes blackmail works even better.
Silk looked over at Geryon, then back at his factor. What do you know about what is happening in Karanda?
Enough to know that it is disastrous for business. All sorts of perfectly respectable and otherwise sensible merchants are closing their shops and flocking off to Kalida to enlist in Minga's army. Then they march around in circles singing death to the Angaraks while they wave rusty swords in the air.
In the chance of selling them weapons? Silk asked quickly.
Probably not. There's not enough real money in northern Karanda to make it worthwhile to try to deal with them. And the political unrest has closed down all of the mines. The market in gemstones has just about dried up.
Silk nodded glumly.
What's really going on up there, Dolmar? The reports Brader passed on to us were sort of sketchy.
Minga arrived at the gates of Kalida with demons.
The factor shrugged.
The Karans went into hysterics and then fell down in the throes of religious ecstasy.
Brader told us about certain atrocities, Geryon said.
I expect that the reports he received were a trifle exaggerated, Your Majesty,
Dolmar replied.
Even the most well-trained observer is likely to multiply mutilated corpses lying in the streets by 10. In point of fact, the vast majority of the casualties were either Malsine or Angarak. Menga's demons rather scrupulously avoided killing Karans, except by accident. The same has held true in every city that he has taken so far.
He scratched at his head, his close-set eyes narrowing.
It's really very shrewd, you know. The Karans see Minga as a liberator and his demons as an invincible spearhead of their army. I cannot swear to his real motives, but those barbarians up there believe that he is a savior come to sweep Karanda clean of Angarak and the Malsine bureaucracy. Give him another 6 months or so, and he will accomplish what no one has ever been able to do before.
And what's that?
Silk asked.
Unify. All of Corenda.
Does he use his demons in the assault on every city he takes?
Garion asked, wanting to confirm what Braedor had told them. Dolmar shook his head.
Not anymore, Your Majesty. After what happened at Kalida and several other towns he took early in the campaign, he does not really have to. All he has been doing lately is marching up to the city. The demons are with him, of course, but they don't have to do anything but stand there looking awful. The Karans butcher all of the Angoraks and Melsines in town, throw open the gates and welcome him with open arms. Then the demons vanish.
He thought a moment.
He always has one particular one with him, though. A shadowy sort of creature that does not seem to be gigantic the way they are supposed to be. He stands directly behind Minga's left shoulder at any public appearance.
A sudden thought occurred to Garion.
Are they desecrating Grolem temples?
Dolmar blinked.
No,
he replied, with some surprise.
As a matter of fact, they are not. And there don't seem to be any Grolems among the dead, either. Of course, it is possible that Ervan pulled all of his Grolems out of Corenda when the trouble started.
That's unlikely, Garion disagreed. Minga's arrival at Kalida came without any kind of warning. The Grolems would not have had time to escape.
He stared up at the ceiling, thinking hard. What is it, Garion?
I just had a chilling sort of notion. We know that Minga is a Grolem, right?
I didn't know that,
Dolmar said with some surprise. We got a bit of inside information, Silk told him. Go ahead, Garion.
Ervan spends all of his time in Malyaska, doesn't he?
Silk nodded. So I've heard. He doesn't want Belden to catch him out in the open.
Wouldn't that make him a fairly ineffective leader? All right, then. Let's suppose that Minga went through his period of despair after the death of Torak and then found a magician to teach him how to raise demons. When he comes back, he offers his former Grolem brethren an alternative to Ervan, along with access to a kind of power they have never experienced before. A demon, in the hands of an illiterate and fairly stupid Karendi's magician is one thing, but a demon controlled by a Grolem sorcerer would be much worse, I think. If Minga is gathering disaffected Grolems around him and training them in the use of magic, we have a big problem. I don't think I'd care to face a legion of Kabats, would you?
Silk shuddered. Oh, not hardly, he replied fervently.
He has to be uprooted, then, Dolmar said. And soon.
Garion made a sour face.
Zakath won't move until he gets his army back from Tol Murgos, about 3 months from now.
In 3 months, Minga is going to be invincible, the factor told him.
Then we'll have to move now, with Zakath or without him,
Garion said. How do you plan to get out of the city? Silk asked.
We'll let Belgarath work that out,
Garion looked at Silk's agent.
Can you tell us anything else?
Dolmar tugged at his nose in a curious imitation of Silk's habitual gesture.
It is only a rumor, he said.
Go ahead.
I've been getting some hints out of Corenda that Minga's familiar demon is named Nehaz.
Is that significant?
I can't be altogether sure, Your Majesty. When the Grolems went into Corenda in the second millennium, they destroyed all traces of Karendi's mythology. No one has ever tried to record what few bits and pieces remained. All that is left is a hazy oral tradition, but the rumors I have heard say that Nehaz was the tribal demon of the original Karans, who migrated into the region before the Angoraks came to Meloria. The Karans follow Minga, not only because he is a political leader, but also because he has resurrected the closest thing they have ever had to a god of their own.
A demon lord? Garion asked him.
That's a very good way to describe him, Your Majesty. If the rumors are true, the demon Nahaz, has almost unlimited power.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Later, when they were back out in the street, Geryon looked curiously at Silk.
Why didn't you object when he burned those documents?
Oh, it's standard practice. The rat-faced man shrugged. We never keep anything in writing. Dolmar has everything committed to memory.
Doesn't that make it fairly easy for him to steal from you?
Of course. But he keeps his thievery within reasonable limits. If the Bureau of Taxation got its hands on written records, though, it could be a disaster. Do you want to go back to the palace now? Geryon took out his list.
No. We've got to take care of this first.
He looked glumly at the sheet.
I wonder how we are going to carry it all.
Silk glanced back over his shoulder at the two unobtrusive spies trailing along behind him.
Oh, help is only a few paces away, he laughed. As I said before, there are many uses for policemen.
During the next several days, Geryon discovered that the Imperial Palace at Malzeth was unlike any court in the West. Since all power rested in Zakath's hands, the bureaucrats and palace functionaries contested with each other for the Emperor's favor and strove with oftentimes wildly complicated plots to discredit their enemies. The introduction of Silk, Velvet, and Zadi into this murky environment added whole new dimensions to palace intrigue. The trio rather casually pointed out the friendship between Geryon and Zakath, and let it be generally known that they had the Riven King's complete trust. Then, they set back to await developments. The officials and courtiers in the Imperial Palace were quick to grasp the significance and the opportunities implicit in this new route to the Emperor's ear. Perhaps, without formally discussing it, the trio of Westerners neatly divided up the possible spheres of activity. Silk concentrated his attention on commercial matters, Velvet dabbled in politics, and Zadi delicately dipped his long-fingered hands into the world of high-level crime. Though all of them subtly let it be known that they were susceptible to bribery, they also expressed a willingness to pass along various requests in exchange for information. Thus, almost by accident, Geryon found out that he had a very effective espionage apparatus at his disposal. Silk and Velvet manipulated the fears, ambitions, and open greed of those who contacted them with musician-like skill, delicately playing the increasingly nervous officials like well-tuned instruments. Zadi's methods, derived from his extensive experience in Salmisra's court, were in some instances even more subtle, but in others, painfully direct. The contents of his red leather case brought premium prices, and several high-ranking criminals, men who literally owned whole platoons of bureaucrats, and even generals, quite suddenly died under suspicious circumstances. One of them, even toppling over with a blackened face and bulging eyes in the presence of the Emperor himself. Zakath, who had watched the activities of the three with a certain veiled amusement, drew the line at that point. He spoke quite firmly with Geryon about the matter during their customary evening meeting on the following day.
"I don't really mind what they are doing, Geryon," he said, idly stroking the head of an orange kitten who lay purring in his lap. "They are confusing all of the insects who scurry around in the dark corners of the palace. And a confused bug cannot consolidate his position. I like to keep all of these petty bootlickers frightened and off balance, since it makes it easier to control them. I really must object to poison, however. It is far too easy for an unskilled poisoner to make mistakes."
"Zadi could poison one specific person at a banquet with 100 guests, Geryon assured him.
"I have every confidence in his ability," Zakath agreed. "But the trouble is that he is not doing the actual poisoning himself. He is selling his concoctions to rank amateurs. There are some people here in the palace
that I need. Their identities are general knowledge, and that keeps the daggers out of their entrails. A mistake with some poison, however, could wipe out whole branches of my government. Could you ask him not to sell any more of it here in the palace? I would speak to him personally, but I do not want it to seem like an official reprimand.
I'll have a talk with him,
Geryon promised.
I would appreciate it, Geryon.
The Emperor's eyes grew sly.
Just the poisons, though. I find the effects of some of his other compounds rather amusing. Just yesterday, I saw an 85-year-old general in hot pursuit of a young chambermaid. The old fool has not had that kind of a thought for a quarter of a century. And the day before that, the chief of the Bureau of Public Works, a pompous ass who makes me sick just to look at him, tried for a solid half hour in front of dozens of witnesses to walk up the side of a building. I have not laughed so hard in years.
Niacin elixirs do strange things to people. I'll ask Sadi to confine his dealings to recreational drugs,
Geryon smiled.
Recreational drugs, Sagath laughed. I like that description.
I've always had a way with words, Geryon replied modestly.
The orange kitten rose, yawned, and jumped down from the Emperor's lap. The mackerel tabby mother cat promptly caught a black and white kitten by the scruff of the neck and deposited it exactly where the orange one had been lying. Then she looked at Zakath's face and meowed questioningly.
Thank you,
Zakath murmured to her. Satisfied, the cat jumped down, caught the orange kitten, and began to bathe it, holding it down with one paw.
Does she do that all of the time? Geryon asked.
Zakath nodded.
She is busy being a mother.
But she does not want me to get lonely.
Well, that's considerate of her.
Zakath looked at the black and white kitten in his lap, who had all four paws wrapped around his hand and was gnawing on one of his knuckles in mock curiosity.
I think I could learn to survive without it, he said, wincing.
Chapter 9. The simplest way to avoid the omnipresent spies infesting the Imperial Palace was to conduct any significant conversations out in the open. And so, Geryon frequently found himself strolling around the palace grounds with one or more of his companions. On a beautiful spring morning, a few days later, he walked with Belgarath and Polgra through the dappled shade of a cherry orchard, listening to Velvet's latest report on the political intrigues which seethed through the corridors of Zakath's palace.
The surprising thing is that Braedor is probably aware of most of what is going on,
the blonde girl told them.
He does not look all that efficient, but his secret police are everywhere.
Velvet was holding a spray of cherry blossoms in front of her face, rather ostentatiously inhaling their fragrance.
At least they can't hear us out here, Geryon said.
No, but they can see us. If I were you, Belgarion, I still would not talk too openly, even out of doors. I happened to come across one industrious fellow yesterday who was busily writing down every word of a conversation being conducted in whispers some 50 yards away.
Well, that's a neat trick, Belgarath said. How did he manage it?
He is stone deaf, she replied. Over the years, he has learned to understand what people are saying by reading the shape of the words from their lips.
Clever, the old man murmured. Is that why you are so busily sniffing cherry blossoms?
She nodded with a dimpled smile.
That, and the fact that they have such a lovely fragrance.
He scratched at his beard, his hand covering his mouth.
All right. What I need is some sort of disruption, something to draw Braedor's police off, so that we can slip out of Malzeth without being followed. Zakath is rock hard on the point of not doing anything until his army gets back from Tol Mergos.
So, it's obvious that we're going to have to move without him. Is there anything afoot that might distract all of the spies around here?
Not really, Ancient One. The petty kinglet of Palia and the Prince Regent of Delshin are scheming against each other, but that has been going on for years. The old king of Vorisebo is trying to get imperial aid in wresting his throne back from his son, who deposed him a year or so ago.